This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
This show, you better run for cover.
Klondike Bill's a sausage lover.
I got a 10-inch kielbasa from Klondike Bill.
Hot traveling fanboys.
Slobber.
It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
Keep your ears in mint condition.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys.
You got a 33-1/3 chance of winning.
Hot traveling fanboys. Hot traveling fanboys. Hot traveling fanboys. Our traveling fanboys.
Got two weekly segments coming to your town.
Reading, watching, and the rundown.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, once again to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. I am Greg Phillips. With me on the other side of the L-shaped studio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, where we are back once again, is my esteemed co-host, Nick Duke. Nick, hello.
Hi. We should mention, I think, that one, this was almost no longer the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, because the L-shaped studio has actually been deemed a quarantine zone for this week. Greg and I are both down with our respective afflictions, his of the gut and stomach, and mine of the sinus and throat and general malaise. So not a good week for the hard traveling fanboys to this point.
No, I feel like this is our penance for our years of making fun of things.
there I go.
Yeah, so if we're extra down in the dumps this week or extra low key, the reasoning is because both of us feel like, well, like what I've been producing a lot of the last 24 hours.
Well, there you are.
And the loser will have to kiss the winners. Well,
arse.
Anyway, so what we're going to do this week is we were originally going to, for the second week in a row, we had kicked down the idea of doing the Surtur Saga as our long book hunters, but we came across some issues with Marvel Unlimited, primarily my access to it, and also then our sicknesses, and so we kicked around some other ideas, but what we ultimately decided is we just want to get through the episode, do a quick and dirty, and we want to keep our weekly segment, so we're just going to do a special reading and watching and the rundown only edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
A very unspecial edition.
That's right.
This is the, you might as well call this the Carl Malone edition, because we are mailing it in today.
We're mailing it in, baby. And it might even be the Carl from The Walking Dead edition, given the quality of what's about to come.
Hey, that's a good point.
But what we're going to do is we're going to get it started right now, cracking with reading and watching.
Reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
There you hear the wonderful jingle. I have to sneeze, so bear with me.
Let's hope there are no squirts associated with said sneeze.
Josh. Actually, it went back in. It didn't come out. But yeah, you're probably right, Nick. Given the way things have been going, that was probably going to happen, and it would have been the second case of an emergency dump on the hard drive band.
Only the second to make air, not the second, because it's happened other times as well.
True. So I don't have any reading. I'm not going to lie, Nick.
I got reading.
All right, let's hit it. Let's hear it.
There's no way I can do a top three, bottom one because I read so many books. But instead, I'll just kind of take you, not issue by issue, but title by title of some of the stuff I caught up on, because I'm kind of not really reading my books in chronological order the way I should be. I'm just reading the titles that interest me the most to get caught up on those, and slowly working my way through my massive stack. But I got a little bit of reading done, so here we go. I read a couple issues of Green Arrow, Green Arrow 32 and 33. 32 is the finale of a four-title crossover into Metal that I didn't read the other three issues for. So there you are, Green Arrow 32. I didn't understand any of it. There was something about Dark Metal and some Robins, and things were just not going well in Gotham City for Green Arrow. But luckily, the next issue, it was just him back in Star City, where I thought we had left off before, picking up a new storyline called The Trial of Two Cities, as Ollie is getting ready to kick off his murder trial that was set up during the Emerald Outlaw storyline. And really good issue once more. We get to see a big reunion between he and Black Canary. They had been kind of on the outs, and Ollie had been out of town for a while, and you know, I really like this book. I like it more than Greg does, but I think the biggest thing that Ben Percy has going for him is he writes that Black Canary and Ollie dynamic very, very well, mm-hmm. and it keeps me coming back and enjoying it. So
yes, now he is an Emerald Outlaw. Is it revealed at any point that he is half Cherokee and Choctaw?
No, but he does have Indian in-laws, which is a shocking thing.
That is, I mean. You know, I've heard that sometimes your Indian in-laws can have butts bigger than the Beatles.
Well, now that's true. And sometimes when Ollie is out fighting crime, if he's had a particularly tough night, you know, sweating and whatnot, he can develop a stinking problem.
You've already exhausted my Judd knowledge, sadly.
Anyway, moving on. The other title I caught up on, one of the other titles I caught up anyway, it was Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. And this was kind of an interesting one because it spanned the four issues I read, those being 29, 30, 31, and 32, kind of spanned four different storylines. 29 wrapped up the Fall of the Gods, New Gods storyline in a somewhat satisfactory fashion. This was probably one of my least favorite storylines of this title since Rebirth, but still a very entertaining read nonetheless. Robert Venditti just continues his remarkable turnaround. Then we got a really fun little two-parter called Mind Games that featured a guest appearance from Superman. Apparently, over in the pages of Superman, Sinestro had popped up at one point, and so he contacts Hal to let him know that Sinestro had been there, and there had been some issues. And along the way, we get some interference from the Kroletaeans, we get some Hector Hammond, and it's just all around a really fun little two-parter drawn by Patch Zercher, who does a hell of a job on it. So really enjoyed this one. Kind of picks it back up from the Fall of the Gods storyline, like I said, that I didn't enjoy as much as some others. And then finally, 32 is part three of another four-title crossover into Metal that I am not reading the other parts of. This one being Bats Out of Hell. And it largely focuses on Hal Jordan doing battle with the evil, warped Batman version of himself, the Dawnbreaker, as they do battle and they kind of have a conversation about their differences and the experiences they've had. And pretty good little fun issue, although I am a little frustrated at how widespread Metal has become. You know, we criticize Marvel all the time for loading events down with tie-ins and making what would seem to be essential things take place in tie-ins, and DC's kind of guilty of it here. I think the metal tree has kind of spread a little bit too far for my taste, and I'm hoping they'll be able to rein it in as the event draws to a close for the next few months. And I say, once again, thank God they're not taking this approach with Doomsday Clock. I think that is absolutely the right approach to take. 12 issues, self-contained, don't worry about crossovers, and you know where you have to spend your money. You don't have to worry about whether something is relevant or not. So, yeah, not pleased with the state of the metal crossovers at this point. Moving on to, I think I may have already mentioned this on the podcast before, Greg, but I'm going to mention it again just because of how great it was. I'll mention it in brief. The Mighty Thor, number 700, the first part of the Marvel Legacy renumbering. The Death of the Mighty Thor story kicks off. Just excellent. A 50-page oversized issue with a variety of writers, a variety of artists. Just great stuff. I mean, even getting to see something like Throg, the Thor Frog back in the fold again, written by Walt Simonson, I believe, actually, for this issue, his little piece. But other than that, it drives the main narrative forward, and it has me really intrigued as to where this title is going. And there's one page where we get to see some glimpses of potential futures that look very, very interesting. So Mighty Thor 700, give it a look-see, even if you're not a massive Thor fan like myself. Jessica Jones 14 continues the Return of the Purple Man storyline. Excellent. I was very concerned about how the Purple Man was going to be handled during his return. I didn't think anything could live up to his original interactions with Jessica back in the pages of Alias, but I'm glad to report I was wrong. This is the Purple Man coming at Jessica from a whole new angle and screwing with her head in ways that, you know, I never really anticipated. So I don't want to give too much away for those who are reading it, but it is remarkable. Absolutely remarkable thus far, just two issues in. Then I also caught up on the Detective Comics Lonely Place of Living story, 967 and 968, the two issues that kind of bring it home, and just outstanding. Possibly for my money, and I say this as someone who's not very familiar with Tim Drake or not a huge Tim Drake fan, possibly the definitive Tim Drake story for my money. I think it was just outstanding from beginning to end, and I can't wait to see how they follow up on it with Fall of the Batman, which supposedly is coming up next. Then I caught up on Batman, issues 33 and 34. This storyline is called The Rules of Engagement, and this features Batman taking a trip to the Middle East with Catwoman in tow, and they come into conflict with Batman's ex, Talia al Ghul. So you get all these interesting conflicts and dynamics between Selina and Talia. Talia getting the news that they are that he and Selina are engaged to be married. It's just a fun little story thus far. Drawn by Joel Jones on guest art, but Tom King continues to write the hell out of this one. Loving the way this Batman title is going thus far. Aquaman 29 continues the Underworld storyline, and I am absolutely loving this one as well. Mira continues to play a major role on the outside, trying to get into Atlantis. Meanwhile, we see Arthur still lurking in the depths of Atlantis, trying to stay out of the sight of King Wrath. And we get a reveal here with a particular character that had me fist pumping at the end, because I knew there had to be more to it than what we had seen thus far, and I was glad to see that there was. And Skip John Sajic continues to be one of the best artists in the DC fold right now. And then finally, I caught up on Metal. No, not Metal, the story itself, but rather some of the tie-ins that I was just bitching about a few minutes ago. I picked up Batman the Drowned, which was the story of the female Aquaman version of Batman. The story being that this female version of Bruce Wayne from the negative multiverse lost her beloved Sylvester Kyle during the during a war between the surface and Atlantis, and she then underwent numerous surgeries to give her the ability to breathe underwater so that she could take the fight to Atlantis firsthand, and wound up taking over the throne by force and becoming something of a tyrant. Interesting little book, and cool to see, you get to see in these pages Mira and Aquaman back together. So I'm not really sure where Metal fits in to the larger DC timeline, but in these pages, Arthur and Mira are back together and running roughshod. Batman the Merciless, written by Peter Tomasi and drawn by Francis Manapul. This is the evil Ares version of Bruce Wayne from a different universe. The story here being that he took on Ares's armor by force after he thought Ares had murdered Wonder Woman, who he was in love with, and it drove him insane and drove him to become, again, a tyrant. Imagine that. And then the last page reveal, I don't want to spoil, but it actually puts a fun little twist on the character, one that I didn't see coming, and kind of separates him a little bit from some of these other evil Batman that I've read thus far. And then finally, Batman Lost. This is the big Scott Snyder, James Tynion, Josh Williamson, Doug Monkey. I mean, like eight names on the front of this book. And it was well written and it was well drawn. I can't deny that. But I don't know, man. It really drove home for me the fact that Metal as a concept may not really be for me, because In this one, Greg, Snyder has gone full Morrison. He is leaning 100% into the everything happened take that Morrison had on the character. Weird, trippy, you know, psycho babble at times. Batman being lost in his own consciousness. Just it's by far even beyond the main metal issues themselves. I would argue it's the most Morrison feeling thing Batman has or Snyder has written on the character to this point, and it just, I don't know, well written, well drawn, but not my cup of tea is the best way I can put it. And that's it. That's all I got.
Very good. Very good. Interesting thoughts from my hard traveling companion. And with that, we are going to move on to watching. And we had another just loaded slate of comic book television in this past week. Where should we begin?
Let's start with Walking Dead. Why don't we?
Start with Walking Dead. Walking Dead changed courses a little bit this week. Most weeks we've seen kind of a mix of foci, if you will, focuses on in the show. You'll see kind of a division between the four main groups that have split off to launch this part of their plan of all-out war against Negan and the Saviors. This episode's a little bit different. And it's apparent from the get-go, because this episode is all about Kang, Ezekiel. We get a little bit of a flashback to when he first becomes Kang, Ezekiel, and undergoes that physical transformation. We see him in what looks to be a hotel room or a building of some kind and undergoing that transformation. And then we follow Ezekiel in the aftermath of last week's ambush. At the end of the episode last week, of course, the Saviors had ambushed Ezekiel and his loyal soldiers with 50 caliber machine guns. And in this episode, we get to see how the king reacts when faced with the reality of his decisions. We've seen a very optimistic, very upbeat Ezekiel this year, using his ability to influence and to inspire those around him. Fake it till you make it, if you will. Well, now we're seeing what happens when fake it till you make it is faced with the harsh reality of war. And we get to see a noble character push to his breaking point, as Ezekiel is kind of faced with the reality that all of those people that he led into battle and all those families that he took them away from to lead into battle are now dead, and that his promise that they would lose not one person in their group proved not to be true. Meanwhile, he and Jerry and Carol are kind of the three main characters in this episode as they hang on for dear life, along with the I don't even know if you ever got a name, the dorky glasses wearing guy that kind of looked like a serial killer.
Yes,
that was carrying Ezekiel around.
The Savior.
He's kind of one of the Saviors. Yeah, and he claims, of course, to be Negan, as they all do, and. Yeah, this episode kind of focuses on that, and we also, along the way, get a pretty tragic loss, actually, Nick. One that I was not expecting to be as affected by as I was, and I chalked that up largely to the acting of Kari Payton,
yes,
who is King Ezekiel, who put on a tour de force performance here. Also, we get to see Carol being a badass, and when you all add all of this up, oh, and I haven't even mentioned one of the best action scenes on The Walking Dead in a long time, when Rick and Daryl launch an assault on a transport truck by the Saviors, and it's something right out of like Lethal Weapon or something. Daryl comes riding up on his motorcycle. Rick does the classic Martin Riggs jumping from one vehicle to the other. I thought, all in all, this is the best episode of the season at this point. Nick, what did you think?
Yeah, I would probably agree. It managed to give us at least one really standout action scene, along with, like you said, really pack an emotional punch. So it kind of had the best of both worlds here, and I absolutely I loved it. Jerry probably had the biggest fist pump moment for me when he popped in and saved Ezekiel from what looked like certain doom. I was worried
by splitting a man in half.
He did, and I was worried that Jerry had met an untimely end, but luckily he had not. So glad to see that Jerry is still there, even if one of Ezekiel's other companions is no longer.
Yeah, I told Jenny, one of the co-hosts of Geek and Sassy, we were talking about Walking Dead the other night, and I told her I was incredibly nervous for Jerry in that escape sequence, if you will, when they're getting out of there and they're trying to evade the hordes. I thought for sure Jerry was going to fall on his sword, so to speak, for the king, and I'm very happy that he survived, even though... I'm not going to lie. I got misty-eyed at the sacrifice that was made by the by the companion that was made there. And it was very powerful. And Ezekiel, his character, has to be near the top of the best characters on the show at this point.
Yes.
With this added depth. Just a really strong episode.
I agree completely.
And that brings us to Monday night and the premiere of Supergirl. Not the premiere, but the episode of Supergirl that we saw. And it saw the return of a character we haven't seen much of, if anything of, since his first appearance this season. And that's Morgan Edge.
Meh. Morgan Medge.
Morgan Edge, who... seems to be filling the generic, rich, businessman villain character that would normally go to Lex Luthor or Luthor or Luger in a Superman adaptation, but also went to Maxwell Lord in the first season of Supergirl. So we get Mr. Edge back here, and he's very upset with Lena Luthor, appropriately enough, because Lena Luthor, as some may recall, stole the Catco industry in his eyes, out from underneath him. And so he launches a very convoluted plan to frame Lena Luthor for the sicknesses of many, many children around the National City area.
That is technically a spoiler, because that's not revealed late in the episode. So.
And he does this... basically by passing the blame on to Lena for the lead bomb that was set off at the end of last season.
Uh-huh.
And so what we see in this episode is Lena blaming herself for these actions. She believes that she is responsible, and she viewed this as her one chance at redemption, her one chance to prove that she had a good heart and had good intentions, and now it's all out the window because of this. And... meanwhile, Kara and Samantha, who are Lena's friends, Kara puts on the reporter hat, and Samantha helps out as they try to determine exactly what's going on here. We also get the final breakup of Maggie and Alex, or Malix, if you will, and they are no longer together, and they have to go their separate ways. As a result of the baby issue. And ultimately, we end up seeing, I feel like, a lot of character development for Lena Luthor, a lot of character development for Samantha, as she continues to be a really strong character. Mm-hmm. It's only going to make it more tragic as she inevitably turns into Rain as the season progresses. And we see in this episode some more signs of that. And we get to see Kara just being an awesome person again. So, and of course, we get to see a lot of Morgan Edge chewing scenery. I didn't mind Morgan Edge as much as I think you did, Nick. I thought he was entertaining enough in his role and, you know, certainly delightfully evil, gleefully evil. But
yeah, it's just that his role is so bland and generic. Like, it is evil businessman, you know, number four. Like, it's not really any different than Maxwell Lord or any different than anything else we've seen. So, I just kind of... I don't know. I kind of yawned at it and rolled my eyes at it. The guy's given a decent performance, but it's not the most interesting take on a Supergirl villain this season, I would argue.
Yeah, I would agree. And again, a lot of these are situations we've seen Supergirl in the past. It wasn't... You know, I thought this was an okay episode. I liked aspects of it. I love all the Samantha stuff. I love seeing Kara, you know, have to dig deep and help people with ways other than her powers, and just mainly her belief in somebody. So I like that, but, you know, there were things that didn't work for me. Morgan Edge was okay, I thought, but again, very generic, as you mentioned. And although the scenes were very well acted and very well performed, maybe I'm alone on an island on this. I still kind of feel like the Maggie and Alex breakup has been a little rushed.
Well, yeah, it has been, but that's because Adriana Lima is leaving the show. So I mean, like, that's
right.
They're trying to deal or do the best they can with the bad hand they've been dealt. So, I did think it was a little weird having the actual breakup off screen, because when we pick up this episode, they're packing their stuff already. So that was odd to me, but
it was interesting for sure. And I think that's kind of one of my issues is, as good as that episode was, and it's probably been my favorite so far this year, I think, of Supergirl, which was the one where Maggie's dad came to town.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wonder if maybe you don't move that an episode sooner and give us a little bit more time to breathe in the breakup, if you will. But
right.
Nevertheless, a solid enough episode.
It was all right.
Tuesday night brings us The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all about bachelor and bachelorette parties for the impending wedding of Barry Allen and Iris West. And it brings a guest star to town in the form of Felicity from Arrow, Felicity Smoke. She drops by to help the gals out with a bachelorette party. But unfortunately, Caitlin's been keeping some secrets, and those kind of nasty figures, very nasty, sad figures from her, the first episode that we saw hanging around her, come back to haunt her in a big bad way during their bachelorette party. And it kind of sets up a situation where the ladies have to be the heroes of the episode, and they are the ones that are involved in all the action against a new villain whose name escapes me. Amunet, I believe.
Amunet Black, yes.
Amunet Black. Meanwhile, the guys go to a strip club at the behest of Ralph Dibny, who is now on the team, and Cisco makes the foolish decision to make Barry an elixir that will allow him for the first time in his life first time since he's had these powers, to experience being drunk. And it gets him way drunk, and provides probably my favorite part of the episode, Drunk Barry, as he is particularly the line about, he goes, pew! And Cisco goes, what are you doing? And he goes, oh, I was just going to pick up peanuts. And then Joe goes, you didn't go anywhere. Are you sure? That was really good. It was a really good episode overall. We get Joe finally admitting that he's not 100% excited about being a dad. He's very fearful about it. Being a dad again, I should say. And we get some really good action bits there with the girls getting to, you know, pool their minds together and come up with solutions. We get Caitlin seemingly resolving the Killer Frost issue for now, and although it probably will pop up again.
How many times has that been seemingly resolved over the last two seasons?
475.
It's the new Thea going off to find herself. It's
right. I told you at the end of last season. I said Caitlin going off to find herself is going to be the new Thea going off to find herself.
No. Caitlin seemingly resolving her Killer Frost powers specifically is the new, because now hasn't gone off to find herself. But
I'm still a little unclear as to what we saw at the end there. So is Killer Frost just okay with going away now? Is that what I'm taking out of that?
I have no idea, sir.
Nevertheless, we did get to me, this is a tale of two episodes. All of the parts with the camaraderie between both the women and the men were great. In particular, I mentioned Drunk Barry interacting with his friends. I think Ralph Dibny being kind of obnoxious has added to the show, because I think you need that kind of, and similar to how Julian was at the beginning of last season, you need that kind of antagonistic character to throw a little monkey wrench into things. I thought Cisco was funny. Wells was good. I mean, all that stuff was good. Seeing Felicity interact with the other women was great. And I thought all that stuff was good. What I didn't like as much was the villain. Not because of the performance or anything like that, but primarily because she seemed to have a very oddly specific power.
Like, yeah, that was weird. I thought maybe she was just she had power over metal in general, but they never really showed that. So it was
it appeared as if she had to form the glove on her hand to have the ability to manipulate metal. So it was very oddly specific, and I didn't understand necessarily what made her so incredibly powerful that Killer Frost was terrified of her.
Yeah,
I don't think they did a great job of getting that across.
No, they did not. I will agree with that. But yeah, like you said, though, the rest of the episode, very good. Ralph continues to be something of a breath of fresh air on the show, in my opinion. I thought he was hilarious in these episodes, though I can kind of understand some people who are starting to say that he's more of a Plastic Man than he is a Ralph Dibny, and I can kind of see that a little bit based on my limited exposure to both characters.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. No, I can see that as well. Anything else to say on The Flash?
No, I thought it was a very good episode. Not great because of the villains, but a very good episode.
Yeah, I agree. Let's move on to DC's Legends of Tomorrow. And this is an episode that, as we often do when we talk about Legends, we mainly talk about the setting. And this one took us to 1880s London. And what looks at the beginning to set up like a Jack the Ripper episode, in fact, turns into a vampire episode, which in fact turns into something rather different by the end, more of an occult episode. And this brings Rip back into the lives of Legends as he makes good on something that he kind of hinted at earlier in the season, that there were certain missions that the Legends could do that the Time Bureau would not be able to do. And so he kind of stumbles upon the Legends, or they stumble upon him, and they agree to help each other to solve this mystery in 1880s London that will help Rip track down this time demon called the
Malice, something like that.
Who is this entity that's trying to recruit individuals from throughout time to join his side. And Rip seems to be on the up and up as he helps the Legends out, but things kind of go a little haywire along the way as Rip still can't resist keeping things to himself. And meanwhile, we get the new member, Zari, I believe is her name.
Yes.
And she is trying to come to grips with what's happened to her family back in her timeline and deal with her responsibility for what happened to her little brother. And we see a continuing bond between she and Vixen, Amaya, if you will. And other than that, yeah, we also see the major return of one of last season's big bads at the end of the episode. And he appears to have been recruited into this group by Mollus. Should we spoil that, Nick?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Damian Dark is back. Damian Dark reanimates and has his powers back, seemingly, and it seems to enjoy having his powers back as he takes great delight in beating up the Time Bureau, and who wouldn't? And then by the end of the episode, he's free along with this other woman who is a powerful entity, and they escape. The Legends learn not to trust Rip, and things look like they're going astray. This was kind of an interesting... Oh, and I didn't even mention the stuff with Firestorm. They have mutually now agreed that they want to split the Firestorm Matrix so that Professor Stein can go back home and be with his family, and Jax can continue to be aboard the vessel. And as many of us know, and I think we talked about on the rundown, Nick, the actor who plays Martin Stein will be leaving the show in the near future, so we're pretty sure that that is going to be a success of them splitting the Firestorm Matrix.
Yes. We don't know if he'll have to have another secondary host or not, but we do know that Victor Garber, who plays Professor Martin Stein, will be leaving the show here in the near future. But in any event, yeah, I was a little lukewarm on this episode, honestly. Probably the most lukewarm I've been on an episode of Legends thus far this year. I just felt like it was very scattershot, even for an episode of Legends. Felt like it had a few too many concepts and a few too many plot threads it was trying to weave together at one time. And honestly, it was a little hard to follow at various points how all of this stuff was playing together and what exactly, you know, each party was seeking to obtain. I didn't really follow why Rip was trying to mislead the Time Bureau. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. But, you know, that being said, it's still fun to see these characters together, fun to see the different dynamics, and it was cool to see Damian Dark back. But, I don't know, just something about this episode threw me a little bit off this week.
I liked it a little bit more than you did. I enjoyed seeing Rip back. I think he's a strong addition to the cast whenever you can have him on. And I do agree that it got a little lost in itself at times with the kind of shift from the vampire angle into that not really being a thing and it just being a two-pronged needle that was kind of a... I know it was a red herring and all that, but it almost felt like too much misdirection in the episode, if that makes sense.
Right.
But overall, I still very much enjoyed it, and... again, what makes the show for me is the character dynamics and all of them interacting. Mick being tremendous as always, and Sarah really asserting the fact that she is the captain now. And there was a little bit of that over explained plot where they had Gideon say that she believes this is the last secret command that Rip has over her, so that was kind of, you know, whatever. But nevertheless, I enjoyed this one quite a bit. But let's get on to what I think you will agree with me, Nick, was the main event of the week.
It was.
And that would be Arrow. Yes. On Thursday night. And this is an episode that we've kind of been anticipating for a while, Nick, and this was the return of Deathstroke, Slade Wilson, played by Manu Bennett, as he recruits Oliver on a mission to track down his son, Joe. And this is... There's so much that happened in this episode, Nick. It's almost hard to explain. But we get a... Simultaneously, we return to the flashback formula. But in this case, the flashbacks are not for Oliver. These are flashbacks to a young Slade Wilson.
A younger Slade Wilson, I should say.
Yes, yes. Who was a dad... Of a looks like a 10 or 11 year old Joe, who is following. They're going out camping, but the whole time the crux of the episode is that this camping trip was actually just a front for Slade to pull off a hit, and to assassinate a target. And we get an implication, although it's not explicitly stated, but I thought it was pretty well implied that Joe watches his father kill this man, and that sets the course of events that lead us to where we are. And so Slade has to go and try to convince Oliver, not the Green Arrow, but Oliver, because he wants to handle this diplomatically to help extract his son from this European prison. And what we got before we even get to the heart of the episode, we got some great scenes of Oliver going back and forth over whether to do this, because remember, he's promised his son William that he's not going to do this life anymore, that he's getting out of it. And I think what we see is both William and Felicity, importantly, Felicity is really the one that gets through to Oliver and says, just tell William what's going on, tell him you need to help a friend, and he'll understand, because she knows Oliver well enough to know that if he doesn't do this, that he'll blame himself later on. And so Oliver begrudgingly agrees to go help Slade. And while they're over there, things go sideways, and then we get a pissed off, revenge oriented Deathstroke. And it leads to what I think is one of the best action scenes that I can ever recall seeing on network television. It was cinematic in nature. As Deathstroke breaks into a warehouse and just absolutely decimates this rogue group that he's going after. And then, of course, we get a twist reveal at the end. I guess I forgot to mention, we also had the reveal of Vigilante, but it almost felt unimportant with all the Slade stuff going on. But we get the reveal of Vigilante from last season. As he returns to town, we get some nice action sequences, some suspenseful scenes there, and we find out that the Vigilante has a tie a very strong tie to Dinah Lance, the new Black Canary, and that leads to another subplot that appears to be playing out over the course of the season. But this episode just kicked ass, in my opinion, Nick, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I absolutely love the action sequence, as you did. I love the flashbacks to a younger Slade having this something of a strained relationship with his son. Pretty much everything that happened in this episode, I thought, was just really, really well done, with the exception of the vigilante reveal that I thought was a little rushed for my money. But I am at least interested to see where it goes. I think it has a lot of potential, and it is going to be able to give a certain member of the team a little bit more of an arc than that character has enjoyed to this point, I would argue.
Agreed. And I thought that that particular reveal was very well acted, and I thought the scenes between them were very well acted, and in a way that the previous the previous Black Canary, I don't think, would have been able to deliver this style of scene as well, in my opinion. So I was a big fan of that aspect of it. And yeah, I mean, that I can't say enough about this action scene. If you even if you don't watch Arrow, find a way to watch that sequence of Slade infiltrating the warehouse from this week's episode. It was the choreographers, the stunt team, they deserve so much credit for that scene. It was amazing. And always the dichotomy between Oliver and Slade is just something I love so much. The fact that he was so worried about Oliver breaking his own code and breaking his promise to William, that he drugs him to keep him from interjecting himself and helping him, which still doesn't stop Oliver. I think it was just a great example of storytelling and character development.
I absolutely agree. Glad to see that dynamic continuing to evolve in ways that we wouldn't necessarily have expected a couple of seasons ago.
And with that being said, it's time to rank them. And this is a tough week for me, Nick, not because of the usual reasons. This week I thought there was a clear number one in Arrow, and then it just becomes how I separate them out from there, how I glean them out from there. And I think I've gone back and forth on this throughout the day, but as we sit here in the studio and I look you eye to eye through the reflective mirror in the corner of the L-shaped studio, I think I am going to go with Flash at 2, Legends at 3, and Supergirl at 4.
Exactly the same.
And there you have it. No controversy to create any cash here amongst the hard-traveling fanboys this week.
None.
With that being said, we are going to get ready here to take a little break, a little break-ski, if you will. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to have the rundown for you. And boy, oh boy, Nick, do we have some exciting topics lined up for the rundown.
We do indeed, including some that, oh, we hate being serious, but we're going to be forced to be here in the back half of the show.
Yes, indeedy, doddly do. And we hope you stay with us and listen to the advertisements for all our great fellow podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Podcasts such as Sellers Points, podcasts such as Geek and Sassy, podcasts such as Conversation Comics, and of course, Imaginary Stories Podcast.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of The Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Pleased to be back right here in the...
Pleased to be back. What a... That's an interesting way to bring us back in. Yep.
We're always delighted to please our customers, much like the employees of Chick-fil-A.
How may we serve you?
That's right. I also made a mistake before the break. I did not give a plug to some of our other Placement Nation Pop podcasts, including David Sunday's Sunday Groove.
Yes, David Sunday's Easy Like David Sunday. That's right.
And the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular. And, of course, the wrestling podcast over Place to Be Nation. Now, we are ready for our weekly look at the news and notes in the comic book world. A little segment you and I know as Welcome to the Rundown.
The Rundown.
So, we mentioned, or Nick alluded to before the break, we have to uncharacteristically be serious for a minute, like Citizen Lance Storm, and kick things off with a bevy of not-so-nice stories about sexual harassment and the people who perpetrate that. And the first big news item is that longtime DC Comics group editor Eddie Berganza, he's been working at DC since the mid-90s, I believe, he has been terminated by DC Entertainment. And here's the statement issued by Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers and DC Entertainment have terminated the employment of DC Comics Group editor Eddie Braganza. We are committed to eradicating harassment and ensuring that all employees, as well as our freelance community, are aware of our policies, are comfortable reporting any concerns, and feel supported by our company. Now, Braganza was suspended over the weekend after new sexual assault allegations were made public in a BuzzFeed story. Braganza started with DC in 92. And has been accused of sexual harassment publicly in the past. This is a story that seems to resurface every few years, but finally something was done about it. And for a lot of people, this is good news, and for a lot of people, this is overdue news. Yeah, it's kind of a not a great look for DC that it's taken this long for these.
And it's especially frustrating that it isn't necessarily like the fact that the allegations surfaced or that new allegations were brought forward. It's just that they were given a high-profile piece on BuzzFeed. Like, all of these are not, I won't say completely known, but this kind of stuff surrounding Braganza has been around for the better part of, like, 5 years now. And
yes,
it's sad that it took... I mean, they're only doing it for positive PR, not because it's actually the right thing. So it's a really, really bad look for DC, in my opinion.
Right, and the good news in all of this is that at least something was finally done, and hopefully this can create a new environment and maybe even bring back some of the people that were alienated by Braganza's continued employment at DC. So from there, we move on to another DC property, in fact, and that is the Arrowverse. Which we praise every week here as we love the shows. Well, one of the three kind of head guys in the Arrowverse, there's the triumvirate of sorts of Berlanti, Guggenheim, and this guy, Andrew Kreisberg. Pretty shocking news came out recently that Andrew Kreisberg has been accused of sexual harassment and inappropriate physical contact by over a dozen coworkers, according to a report by Variety. Warner Brothers TV Group says they've recently been made aware of these allegations and has suspended Kreisberg and are conducting an internal investigation. They say, "We take all allegations of misconduct extremely seriously and are committed to creating a safe work environment for our employees and everyone involved in our productions." The allegations include kissing, unapproved touching, sexualized comments, and asking for massages. Variety cites 19 sources with details of misconduct by Kreisberg. However, all said that they didn't report it to the company and asked to remain anonymous in the story for fear of retaliation. The victims are described as current or former employees of shows Kreisberg has worked on. Kreisberg told Variety, "I have made comments on women's appearances and clothes in my capacity as an executive producer, but they were not sexualized. Like many people, I have given someone a non-sexual hug or kiss on the cheek." Kreisberg is the showrunner and co-showrunner on The Flash and Supergirl, and also a producer on Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow. Greg Berlanti, who's the head of Berlanti Productions that oversees the shows, says, "We were recently made aware of some deeply troubling allegations. We have been encouraging and fully cooperating with the investigation." Supergirl star Melissa Benoist tweeted a statement following the news, quote, "I'm a woman who leads a show that supports equality and feminism, empowerment, and fighting for what is right. I have always tried to conduct myself that way personally as well. Sadly, the show and my career are a part of an industry that doesn't always mirror these sentiments. This is heartbreaking and at times makes me feel helpless. I know I'm not the only one who feels this way, but I'm an optimist. I believe lasting change is possible, and when people are mistreated, they should have a safe forum to speak their truth and always be heard. And when people commit crimes or harass others, they should always be held accountable, no matter what industry they work in or how much power they wield." She says, "I've spoken up about it in the past, publicly and not so publicly, and I'll continue to." And that's basically it.
Welcome to this portion of the show known as Greg Reads the News.
Exactly. Exactly. This can also be heard on local sports radio shows throughout the greater Southeast region. Now, also this week, as a result of there's so much to digest here, and we'll get into the Kreisberg situation itself. But as a result, Guggenheim, who's the showrunner of Arrow, or was the showrunner of Arrow, and one of the main producers of all the shows, tweeted out something along the lines of something of controversial nature. He basically retweeted a Conan O'Brien joke about how he's ready for the all-female reboot of America and said, no, reverse sexism is not the answer, which led to Emily Bette Rickards, who plays Felicity Smoke on Arrow, tweeting out that anyone who has remained silent in the wake of these allegations and anyone who uses terms like reverse sexism is part of the problem. So none of this is a great look at all, obviously. I will say the good news here, if there is any good news, is that these reports weren't made and ignored. The sources are saying they never reported it, and DC appears to be taking it seriously. Berlanti appears to be taking it seriously, but definitely a bummer of a news story.
Yeah, absolutely. Very unexpected, as you said, just because, I mean, with a show like Supergirl that attempts to portray women in such a positive light, it's a little surprising that somebody so heavily involved would be, you know, guilty of these things. But I guess you can't really be surprised by anything at this point when it comes to these sorts of allegations. It seems to be a widespread, rampant problem in the Hollywood culture. So I have a feeling we're going to hear some more things, and it's going to get a little bit worse before it starts to get better. But, you know, like you said, props to DC, props to Berlanti for, you know, taking some action, and we'll see what comes of it. Hard to say at this point what the end result is going to be.
And not to be outdone, we also have word from the DCEU Corner.
DCEU Corner.
And in this one, it is that something that I didn't even know. I did not know that Brett Ratner was involved in the production of Wonder Woman. But
well,
he was.
He has a production company. Owns a production company that had a role in the production of Wonder Woman, yes.
Rat Pack Dune Entertainment. They helped finance the film, and they also helped finance Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, Suicide Squad, and this week's Justice League. Well, turns out Brett Ratner has also been accused of numerous sexual harassment allegations. And as a result, he is off. His production company has been removed from Wonder Woman 2. Or actually, they say that this was done before all this, but nevertheless, Ratner will not be back in producing Wonder Woman 2. And Gal Gadot also allegedly issued an ultimatum in that regard, saying that you know, she wouldn't come back and do the movie if Ratner was still part of it. So this is just all not, in a way it's not good, but in a way it all is good, because maybe the good side of this, Nick, is that this stuff has always gone on, and it's been going on for decades, and now we're finally starting to hear about it, and things are finally starting to get done, and people are finally accepting the stories instead of trying to hush them or push them aside.
Exactly, yeah. As I said a few minutes ago, it seems to be one of those things that just is far more rampant than a lot of us were ever aware of, or wanted to be aware of, I guess would be a better term. I'm sure there have always been stories of these sorts, but I think there are going to be a lot more people outed, but I think part of this is gonna wind up driving something of a positive change going forward, or at least that is my hope.
I think that's all of our hope as well here at Place to Be Nation Pop. I don't want to speak for everybody, but we're all very sensitive to this issue. For some of us, it's an issue that's affecting our own state right now. So it's definitely a lot to take into account and keep in mind and everything. But with that being said, we are going to jettison the serious portion of the show now, and remove our serious tones, and we'll be back to the same old hard-traveling fanboys as we get into the rest. The only other story we have here in the DCEU corner, and it's the continuing seesaw affair that is Ben Affleck's tenure as Batman. 1 week he's finished with the role. The next week he's super excited and can't wait to do 5 more movies. The next week he's done with the role again. And right now the roller coaster appears to have dipped again, as according to Newsarama, actually according to an interview with USA Today, Ben Affleck was asked about the upcoming Matt Reeves' The Batman film, and he says, quote, "It's something I'm contemplating," said Affleck. Quote, "You don't do it forever, so I want to find a graceful and cool way to segue out of it." We don't know anything, Nick. We don't know. That doesn't say that he's not going to do that movie. He could mean that he's going to do that movie and then transition out of it, but certainly it looks like he's kind of had it with the whole being Batman thing.
Yeah, and it feels like he doesn't really want to be here anymore. So I think it would be best for both parties at this point to have an amicable split, a mutually agreed upon decision, because it just feels like his interests lie elsewhere at this point. And I can't blame him.
No, I was about to say, Nick, I wanted to say one thing that's kind of grinding my gears a little bit this week. I have seen a lot of people on Twitter and elsewhere, but a lot on Twitter, which is always the bastion for hot takes in comics and elsewhere, including from people that I like and respect their opinions, like Greg Katzman, who kind of seem to be having this anti-Affleck feeling of like, well, if he doesn't want to play Batman, that's an honor, and he, you know, he should, you know, we should get somebody in there that wants to play Batman. I think he did want to play Batman. I think he genuinely wanted to play Batman until he dealt with the reality that is comic book fandom, and until he dealt with the reality that is I don't think anybody could deny that Affleck dealt with more backlash and more obscene fan reaction than probably any casting announcement that there's been in comics, at least in the modern era, since Keaton in the 80s and all that stuff. And he's had to deal with so much crap from so many critics, so many fans, so many memes at his expense based on his demeanor and talk shows and things like that. I don't blame him for one second, man. The number one thing in life is do what makes you happy. And it wouldn't make me happy to be constantly torn down all the time and constantly second-guessed. And he's dealing with personal problems with a marriage and that went under, and kids and determining custody and things like that. He needs to do what's best for him. And I think comic fans, as they should have a long time ago, need to lay off of Affleck and let the dude do what's best for him.
And it doesn't help that pretty much every movie he's done under this Batman deal so far has had a troubled production, where it just feels like, you know, one roadblock after another and just like a fight to get the movies out. And it can't be a very fun creative process for Affleck. It's not like the Marvel movies where it feels like some of those guys are just having the time of their lives. This really seems like a chore for a dude like Affleck. So, you know, more power to him. I wish him all the best. And here's hoping that they, find a dynamite follow-up and you know, we'll see how the character is affected by Flashpoint whenever that happens in, you know, a couple years.
Indeed. Well said, Nick. Well stated. The next item on our list is news of another movie production, and this comes from the increasingly bizarre Sony non-Spider-Man Spider-Man universe.
Yes.
This is, of course, the production company, Sony Pictures, that is giving us a Venom movie, as well as a Black Cat, Silver Sable crossover movie. And now, according to Variety, we're getting a film about Michael Morbius, the living vampire. Tentatively titled Morbius, the film is said to be part of the Spider-Verse that includes Venom and Silver and Black, and is being worked on by Power Rangers screenwriters Burke Sharpless and Matt Sazama. Burke Sharpless is a pretty great 80s jobber name, I think.
Absolutely.
Now, they previously also worked on my personal favorite horror film of all time, Nick. Perhaps you've heard of it, Dracula Unwatched.
Dracula Unwatched. I see what you did there.
And I was pretty proud of that 3 or 4 years ago when I came up with it. Now, Morbius debuted in 1971's Amazing Spider-Man number 101. Anyone that watched the 90s cartoon remembers Michael Morbius. He was a big deal, kind of a tortured kind of villain, but not really a villain, more of an anti-hero that sometimes was a villain. Really weird choice for a movie, Nick.
Yeah, it really is. You know, we recently had the New Mutants trailer a couple of weeks ago that showed us, you know, a look at what a horror film could kind of be in the comic book pantheon, and maybe this is going to be Sony's take on that. It's hard to say, but it's an exceptionally odd choice. But then again, so is Silver and Black, and I have a feeling that if Venom doesn't do as well as they want, that none of this actually winds up happening, but we'll just have to wait and see, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're dealing with only Spider-Man characters that aren't Spider-Man, I guess Morbius is probably one of the better choices to headline his own movie, come to think of it. But still, kind of, it seems like they're putting all their eggs in a basket that could very easily tip over before the first film even comes out. Nevertheless, we've got another story we talked about last week that Disney was trying to buy Fox, or at least the 21st Century Fox film, TV, things of that nature, intellectual properties. And CNBC, which broke the initial story and then later updated it to say the deal was done, was off, now has updated it again to say that the deal is still on the table. Bloomberg had written that the talks had stalled and that the deal was no longer possible. Now CNBC directly contradicts that, saying that it does appear at the very least that both companies have not abandoned the idea of that combination. Pencils aren't down on the deal, he said. So basically, this is just an update for you guys. We don't have any other extra information about this. Nothing's changed, I think, about our feelings from last week. I'm still trepidatious about it, but yet at the same time, if you gave me the experimental X-Men films with a new Wolverine, and then you gave me Hugh Jackman interacting with the Avengers, I could deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, I am a few minds about it as well. I think it would spell almost certain doom for the Deadpool franchise, but then again, getting to see the Avengers and the X-Men on the screen together at the same time, damn it, it might all be worth it, Greg. It might just all be worth it. I don't know.
If you've seen the new Deadpool teaser commercial that they released, I'm not sure it would be worth it. Which, if you haven't out there, listeners, just go find it. Just type in Deadpool Bob Ross.
Yes.
And then a word that I'm not going to repeat here that stuck with me after the video.
Fuck Knuckle.
That's the one. Now, speaking of Marvel Comics, let's move on to the printed page, because Marvel has unleashed an announcement this week that's got people buzzing and talking about what it could possibly mean. And that is that Marvel has released a new promotional graphic promoting, quote, the Wedding of the Century on June 20, 2018. Now, first of all, Nick, do you think that this timing is just coincidental, the fact that Batman and Catwoman will likely be headed towards a potential marriage issue around that same time?
I hadn't heard that confirmed by DC, that they were going to be heading towards a marriage issue at that point. Is that the timing of it?
That's an assumption on my part. That's assuming that based on the fact that we just had a major proposal from a major character, couple right, in DC, and the fact that Marvel has not exactly been super excited about doing major weddings in recent years.
Right.
But maybe not. Maybe it is just coincidental.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when the Batman Catwoman payoff is supposed to be coming. I had not heard June. If you've heard something, then yeah, obviously.
No, I haven't.
But that's not something that I was aware of.
That's just a guess on my part, because it would be about a year after the engagement. So, but anyway, there was a bunch of couples shown on the page. Of the one shown, only two remain married: North Star and Kanadu, and Reed Richards and Sue Storm. Who it gonna be, Nick? Who gonna get married?
I have no idea, because I am so far removed from the larger Marvel continuity at this point. I am going to guess, and this is just a wild guess, I'm going to go Wolverine and Jean Grey.
Oh, my. Oh.
I think it...
Vince Giff.
They both have been recently resurrected from the dead.
Yes.
And Marvel has attempted over the last year or so to put a renewed focus on the X-Men titles, and I think this would be a way to further that, and could also potentially provide for...
Has Wolverine been resurrected yet?
Yes.
Has it already happened?
Yes.
Okay.
That happened in the Marvel Legacy one-shot.
How they explain it?
He just popped up in the Marvel Legacy one-shot, and I didn't read the X titles that followed it, so that's not a question for me to answer, but he was there doing things. In any event, I think that there's a lot of potential that they could do that, and then have the big climactic moment of, you know, if anybody has any reason, these two should not be married, and that's where Cyclops makes his return from the dead to voice his opposition. That's just my fantasy.
But how dare anyone put soap opera elements into a comic book television show?
I'm not.
As we know, there are no similarities.
None whatsoever.
None at all. But I have a guess of my own, Nick, but you may be able to shoot this down through your – I know you have been reading a little bit of this series. My first thought was Tony and Pepper.
Right. The first step to that –
parallel with the films.
Right. The first step to that would be getting actual Tony back and not artificial intelligence Tony.
Right.
And I don't know where that stands at the moment. I haven't been reading Iron Man recently, so I don't know if that's – if that's coming or if that's on the table, but they've pretty much just had Tony running around with a hologram head for the last several months.
Maybe Tony could marry himself.
Maybe he could.
In virtual form.
Or maybe virtual Tony could marry Pepper. I don't know. So, yeah, it's hard to say what this could be. I'm just, you know, spitballing off the top of my head. No real ideas as to what this could be. But I'm interested to see what they come up with and see if it sticks, which I am betting it will not.
Well, you mentioned her name earlier, and I'm gonna bring her up right now because Marvel has also revealed the lineup to the new, that's right, a new X-Men team, because we needed another one, called X-Men Red to go along with X-Men Blue and X-Men Gold. And this one is going to be led by the resurrected Jean Grey. It'll be written by Tom Taylor, the Tool Man, if you will, known for his work on Injustice and other X-Men titles as well, and artist Mahmoud Azrar with covers from Travis Cherris. That's a great creative team. The new team of X-Men to be led by Jean includes the Wakandan mutant Gentle, Namor the Submariner, Nightcrawler, the all-new Wolverine, her sister Gabby, and the mysterious, never-before-seen Trinary. Nick, your thoughts on X-Men Red and your thoughts on this lineup?
Yeah, on the one hand, it makes some sense to have Jean leading her own team. You know, it would be kind of weird, I think, to have her come back into Blue or Gold and be subservient to someone else. So, interesting to see her getting her own team. And the lineup is very weird and yet kind of exciting. Like, Namor the Submariner as an X-Man, something I never would have thought of, and I'm interested to see how that dynamic goes. Then also, always good to get more X-23. I think they need to be pushing that character harder, given the success of Logan earlier this year, and putting her on one of the main X titles, I think, will be a good selling point for a lot of people. And then, of course, you got Nightcrawler, who's a fan favorite, and then some newer characters to try and give them the rub. This character Gentle, who I know nothing about, and this new character of Trinary, as well as, I'm guessing that's X-23's sister Gabby that's there as well. So,
yes,
kind of a good mix of established characters and new characters.
I guess.
Hopefully you get to raise the profile of some of those new characters. So, I'm not going to read it, but I am all for the concept of it, I guess.
Sure. I just feel like it's a little bit of overexposure for a line that still doesn't feel like it's been streamlined yet.
True.
But that being said,
it's better than underexposure, which was we've had
true,
for the last
which was
five
the problem
years.
For a long time. Absolutely. Yeah. At least they're putting some time and effort into the X-Men. And it does also raise a question for me. Do you think we'll ever get an NBC Universal Namor movie?
I highly doubt it for some reason.
Maybe if Aquaman does well next year.
Maybe.
So Speaking of Aquaman,
is he gonna, no, the most important question is he going to have his massive Steve McNiven drawn package that he was thrusting towards Sue Richards in
towards
Civil War?
Sue Richards during Civil War?
Yes.
Yeah, I have to assume that would be the case. In other
if
words,
if he is, he has to be played by The Rock. Easy,
big fella. Are you saying that he'd have to have a low key big hog?
It was a high key big hog. It wasn't no
high key big hog.
Yes.
Easy, big fella. Well, Aquaman, of course, has a significant other, and her name is Mira. And for the very first time, something that both Nick and I have proposed in our fantasy comics drafts, on our podcasts, in our columns, even going all the way back to the beginning, is finally happening. And Mira is getting a 6-issue DC limited series by Aquaman writer Dan Abnett and artist Lan Medina. And it's called Mira, Queen of Atlantis. And number one drops in February. This is long overdue, in my opinion. Mira has been one of the best characters in DC Comics since Geoff Johns got his hands on her back in 2009, and even going back farther than that. This is spinning out of the pages of Aquaman, obviously, but I'm super pumped for this, Nick. What about you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Dan Abnett going to be writing it, which is very exciting. He and Geoff Johns really are the two that have done the best job with that character over the last, 5 to 6 years. And the fact that he's going to have time to take on both the Aquaman solo title and this Mira solo title is very exciting. It's only a 6-issue mini, but if it does well, I think there is a lot of potential for it to be extended or possibly turned into an ongoing. It's a character that can certainly support it. And the subtitle, Queen of Atlantis, gives me a lot of hope for what's going to play out in the pages of Aquaman between now and then. Something that they teased all the way back in the Rebirth special and that they probably need to be moving forward on here pretty soon is the marriage of Arthur and Mira. Exciting news all the way around as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed completely. We talk about the importance of giving – giving new titles a shot. What's going to help this title is being 6-issue limited series. I'll have no problem adding that onto my pull list. I can eat the cost for 6 months, and it gives some exposure to a character that really needs it. Geoff got his hands on her back in Blackest Night, and then Brightest Day, and then of course with the New 52 relaunch, and it really did amazing things with her. And we're seeing the same thing with Abnett's Aquaman run. So great stuff there. But while we focused on a character there, we've also got some news about a creator, a prominent creator, returning to DC Comics, and that is Michael Lark, who is the co-creator of Lazarus, but to DC fans is most well-known for his work on the landmark series Gotham Central alongside Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka. He's returning to DC to pitch in on this month's Batman Annual number 2. He's going to be contributing to a story alongside Lee Weeks on art, written by Tom King, and this has me excited, Nick, and I know it has you excited because of some of the potential that we could see from a Lark return to the DC fold.
Yeah, let's hope this is not just a one-off. I hope that it represents some more ongoing work for Michael Lark, because I think the potential pairing of Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Lark on some sort of Gotham or other street-level title could be a match made in heaven, if you ask me.
And as we saw at SummerSlam 1991...
I knew you were going to do it.
You occasionally have a match made in heaven, but it's always counteracted by a match made in hell.
That it is.
Although on that night, you probably preferred the match made in hell, didn't you?
I liked them both. You can like both, Greg. It doesn't have to be one or the other. I would sniff, but my nose is so clogged that I can't really return your sniff in a meaningful fashion.
It's a little
hard. What does Feinbaum do when he gets sick?
I don't know. I mean, that he doesn't do a show. He gets a fill-in for him.
I guess.
He gets a fill-in to come in because he can't sniff. Yeah. Oh, he had some Whoppers the other day. It was delightful to listen to. Although, I did get I won't bring that up. Never mind. But yes, he had some whoppers the other day, and in typical Finebaum fashion, often would just say the name of a coach. Brett Bielema.
Kevin Sumlin.
I mean, his days are clearly numbered. I mean, we don't even need to talk about that at this point. That's foregone conclusion. Chip Kelly. With that being said, folks, that brings us to the end of the rundown, and indeed, the end of the show. Now, I know we've lied to you the last couple weeks about what we were going to bring to you, but we're not lying to you about what we're going to bring to you next week.
Nope.
Next week, we're going to bring to you our exclusive review of the new film Justice League. We will be watching it. Nick will be watching it before I will, but we'll both be watching it over the course of the next few days. And by the time our recording is ready next week, we'll have seen it. We'll give you all of our unfiltered thoughts, the highs, the lows, the in-betweens, what we think of this landmark motion picture and what it means for DC films going forward.
Absolutely. That is the plan.
And then we will be... What we'll be doing the following week, Nick?
We haven't really determined that. Greg and I have to have some sort of a production meeting off air, because I just realized what we're supposed to be doing then, and let's just say it might be difficult, and Greg and I will discuss that off air. We will bring to you some sort of thrilling content, I promise.
Absolutely, and until then, we invite you, and I hope that we've got a few new listeners, Nick, because I should mention that this past weekend was Fanaticon, which is a comic and gaming convention in Ozark, Alabama. We were represented well at Place to Be Nation Pop by both members of Geek and Sassy, and both members of the Sellers Points podcast. Russell, Kelly, Jennifer, and Miranda were all there alongside me. We had a panel that we talked about comics to film, met a few really cool people that expressed interest in listening to the show. I hate that their first episode listening is going to sound with both of us sick, you know, but
right.
Nevertheless, we always invite feedback. Let us know what you like, what you didn't like, if you have any questions, whatever. Contact us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at NickDuke87. You can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. It's very simple. Log on to Facebook, type in Place to Be Nation Comics in your search bar. We should be the first group that pops up. Join. We'll have fun. Or you can send us emails to GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com and NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com, respectively. We will check those. We'll get back to you when we can. And let us know your thoughts. What do you want us to talk about? What do you want us to do? What can we do better? And until then, Nick, gosh, I can't think of anything else. What about you?
No, nor can I. Nor can I. I think that's about it. And we apologize again for our sickly ways. But we hope to be feeling better next week and provide you a little bit more of a full-length experience.
And while we do apologize for our sickly ways, this is the part where we must go our separate ways, as the great band Journey once sang.